This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. President Obama leaves office with more popularity than the man who will replace him Friday at noon. The same would have been said had Hillary Clinton won the election. And despite having to deal with a Congress controlled by the opposition party for all but the first two of years of his administration, he has accomplished a lot. It can be argued that he saved the economy by bailing out banks and the auto industry. He re-regulated the financial industry to protect consumers and lessen the possibility of failures at banks too big to fail. He negotiated a deal to block a nuclear Iran, ended U.S. combat missions in Iraq and Afghanistan, and killed Osama bin Laden. He repealed the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy and supported the federal recognition of same-sex marriages, normalized relations with Cuba, and, of course, was the first president to successfully shepherd a health care reform package into existence. And that's just the top of the list. Of course, his opponents dislike or are critical of most, if not all, of those accomplishments, and have their sights set on eliminating more than a few of them. So what will President Obama's legacy be? We look at that this hour with two political scientists, Drs. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College and Susan Roberts from Davidson College. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Good morning. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call, frequent contributor to NBC BLK and WCCB News Writing and NPR. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Good to see you. And Ron Elving is senior editor and correspondent for NPR, where he sits this morning in Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Good to be with you, Mike.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Just before we started, I asked Ron Elving what the mood in Washington is on this Tuesday before the inauguration, and he said, and I quote,
brackish.
That's right. Explain that.
It doesn't feel very good. Now, the people coming into town, I hasten to add, Mike, are quite excited, and they could not be happier, and they're here to celebrate Donald Trump's election. But the people who live here, the people who are the permanent government, and believe me, I know just how popular that expression is. Nonetheless, the people who live here, that is to say the permanent government, are wary at the very least. Obviously, a lot of the Democrats in Congress are unhappy and not even planning to attend the inauguration. I think we're up to about three dozen now who have said so. There'll be lots more who don't talk about it but just don't show up. And there are a lot of people on the Republican side who are a little bit uneasy about Donald Trump and what he may mean for them and their future as well. And then let's remember that the actual people who live in Washington, D.C. and do a lot of the work here, the people who are actually born and raised here or reside here, only about 4% of them voted for Donald Trump. Think about that. 4% in a city of 600 and some thousand people.
Wow. This show is good. This hour is going to be about the Obama legacy. And I mentioned in the promotional announcements for this show that he came into office, actually became onto the national stage 12 years ago by saying he didn't see an America of red states, blue states, conservatives, liberals, Democrats, Republicans. He saw a united America, and he leaves the White House at a time when America is more divided perhaps than any time since the Civil War. Is that, does he have to own that as part of his legacy? Is that his doing?
Part of it is his doing, but part of it is just the environment that we have developed into, I would argue. I think it was a very idealistic speech that he gave in 2004. The country, I think, in general, hungers for the ability to come together, to have some kind of unity. But the parties themselves have become so ideologically pure. And the tribalism that we have nowadays has pretty much, you know, engulfed people to say, if you're not of my ilk, I'm against you. Or you're against me. And I think that's the polarization is something that is going to continue into the Trump administration, but has gotten deeper and wider under the Obama administration.
Susan Roberts.
Well, I think sometimes you have to look at what you accomplish by what you want to do. And the two things that I think sum up what he wanted to do and unfortunately has not been able to do is this. It is not really a post-partisan society. It is not a post-racial society. Mm-hmm. I think the country, as Michael points out, what Obama said in his farewell speech, he called it naked partisanship. And I think that still exists. I think it would exist with the Hillary Clinton presidency today.
We talked a lot about this during the election cycle with political scientists, but I'd like to hear your point of view, Mary, as a columnist who writes about all these issues. It seems that the parties, because of gerrymandering and other factors, now appeal to the extreme left and extreme right. And all the people in the middle are left out of the conversation, and they're the ones left to clean up the mess. Is that how most people feel today, do you think?
Well, I believe that many of the divisions were there already, bubbling under the surface, and perhaps Barack Obama's presidency unearthed a lot of that. You know that the Republicans met, and they said, we're going to obstruct this president. And I'm an African-American woman, and actually grew up in Maryland with moderate Republican parents. And those folks are gone in that sense. The folks that would vote for Charles Mack Mathias, the Ed Brooks, those kinds of Republicans. And I've seen that. But we have to look at the history for good and for ill. That this was the first African-American president of the United States of America, a country with a very fraught and often unspoken about racial history. And he had these high hopes, and he felt that perhaps he could bridge that particular gap and get folks to talk about those issues. But when they went on Earth, some of the sentiments that came out, well, let's just say we are definitely not post-racial.
Yeah.
But he did represent himself with dignity and class. And he was, whether you agree with his policies or not, an example of a strong, smart, empathetic African-American man with an exemplary family. 8 years, let's look at it, without ethical or personal scandals. And this was in itself an example.
Yeah. Let's talk about his accomplishments, other than that being a great family man and somebody who does leave the White House with an unblemished record. I can't think of a recent president who can say that. Maybe George W. Bush, maybe.
He was probably, yeah. I mean, Bush was tied to Iraq, so that dragged his numbers down.
But let's talk about I listed a bunch of accomplishments, or things that he says are his accomplishments. What, did I leave anything off the list, Ron Elving?
That was a pretty good list, actually, Mike. It certainly would be something that would please the White House in terms of a short accomplishment list. There were also a lot of changes, I think, in people's attitudes that are a little harder to measure. And some of that we have already heard about. Mary mentioned that. But I think that there was also a sense that a president who was thoughtful, some people say technocratic, a president who was analytical, some people would say he was a little too cold, a president who really thought hard about the issues and made decisions oftentimes that seemed to be difficult for him to swallow and something he might even oppose if he were still in the Senate. He was willing to do that kind of thing. He was, if you will, he was almost a kind of academic president in certain ways. And that is a legacy that we will probably not see imitated very soon. But it was very deeply satisfying, I think, for a certain kind of intellectual American.
So how would you rank his accomplishments in terms of the amount of things he got done and the breadth, the depth of what he got done? Because health care is a major thing that presidents for years have been trying to accomplish, Republicans and Democrats. And he did it in the face of a recalcitrant Congress. So how do you rank it in terms of numbers and in terms of how it has impacted or changed the country?
Well, I have to say this before I go any further, and I think your listeners might agree. It's difficult for me to assess the legacy of Obama without seeing the lens of where Donald Trump is going to take us, because I'm comparing what Obama did accomplish with what Trump wants to disaccomplish.
That was going to be one of my questions later on. I mean, is that part of his legacy, this whiplash that we are about to experience?
Well, I think it is, because I think he looked in terms of goals and moving forward. And in his, you know, he talked about democracy, participation. He also looked in terms of some things that he might not have accomplished that we would have liked as much in terms of women's rights. Of course, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, some things to take away the gag rules for abortion, be able to talk about access to abortion. You know, I think there are other things on that list, but the checklist has to realize that he took us from the brink of the worst economic collapse since the Great Depression. So he came into office with these challenges.
Yeah, so put that into focus. Did he accomplish a lot? And of his accomplishments, were they meaningful? I mean, the saving us from the Great Recession, I suppose, could be arguably meaningful.
I think the two top things that people will continue to talk about, certainly one is the issue of the economic recession, the deepest that we have seen since the Great Depression, and be able to survive that and really kind of thrive on that. Job creation has been, you know, pretty healthy in comparison to what we were experiencing during that time. I think historians in the future will certainly probably point to that as the major accomplishment that he was able to create. But the Affordable Care Act versus Obamacare is really kind of a fascinating case study, in that if you ask about the individual provisions, for the most part, most Americans agree with it. But you then label it Obamacare, right, and that immediately turns people off. And I think that dichotomy is fascinating.
That's marketing.
Yeah, well, it is. But you can also see that the Republicans have said we were going to repeal that, but they see it's not so easy.
Well, they've also said they're going to repeal and replace it.
Yes.
And is that part of the legacy? The fact that whether you like Obamacare or not, he was able to do something with health care that no president has been able to do, and now they are stuck with it.
Yeah, there are expectations from the public. And as Michael said, when you say, well, but, you know, I'm against Obamacare, but, you know, I really want my kid to be on this, and I have a pre-existing condition. And now you see the constituents flooding their Congress folks' office and saying, right, listen, we want this. So it will be very difficult in so many ways once you make that step to unravel it, whether it's about affordable health care or social issues. We're not going backward. And in that, as you said, Michael, yes, we're stuck.
Ron Elving, a lot of people hope that President Obama would be a transformational leader, somebody who would change how people around the world thought of America, and a leader who would alter the divisive direction of the nation's politics. We know he didn't accomplish the latter. Did he accomplish the former?
To some degree, and surely in the first couple of years of his presidency, people have forgotten now the almost messianic tour that he was able to take of many parts of the world, especially as a candidate. You remember he got the Nobel Peace Prize before he had actually even taken the oath of office, an awkwardness, really, that I don't think he appreciated entirely in terms of its timing. No one ever turns down a Nobel Peace Prize. But the president made a tour of places. He went to Cairo, Egypt, in 2009 and gave a speech there at the university that had a lot to do with everything that happened thereafter in terms of the Arab Spring and so on. He was a focal point for movements all over the world for a period of time, in which many people thought, well, if an African American can be elected president of the United States with a transformational message, maybe we can rise up too.
We have a tweet from Aaron, who says Obama is not responsible for the divide in our country. Many people were unwilling to confront what stirred in them as a black man came to the White House. And we're getting nods around the table. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more on the Obama legacy, what it is, and will it last, in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. And the Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, encouraging listeners to start the new year off right by giving back to the community through blood or platelets donations. CBCC is a local nonprofit blood center dedicated to saving local lives. Among the biggest challenges facing the incoming Trump administration will be those from abroad, particularly problems in the Middle East. The fight against ISIS will continue. Israeli-Palestinian tensions will simmer. The conflict in Syria will most likely be a source of ongoing worry. Republicans have been critical of how President Obama handled all those things, so how will that change? Two international experts help analyze all of this and make some predictions tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Asper. Coming up on the next On Point, Michael Eric Dyson's fiery challenge to white America, stop ignoring the injustices facing black America. He's with us. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded public radio, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Obama legacy. What it is, will it last, with Dr. Michael Bitzer, provost and political scientist at Catawba College, Dr. Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, Ron Elving from NPR. I misquoted the promo that I heard on the way in for, I think, All Things Considered this afternoon, where they talked to somebody in which county?
Yadkin County.
And she said the celebration on election night was like the end of war. She imagined the end of World War II must have been. So that's much bigger than New Year's Eve. They're very happy out there. We had a tweet just a moment ago from somebody who said President Obama was not responsible for the divisions in this country. Scott on Twitter says he divided the country along racial lines. Mary C. Curtis, he keeps being accused of that. And on the other hand, a lot of black people are very unhappy have been unhappy during the course of the last 8 years that he didn't do more. So he's caught between a rock and a hard place.
Well, it's, you know, Jackie Robinson, the stress is on him when he was the first. He is the first. I think people put things on his shoulders that one man could not do. He could not solve every racial issue in the country. But because he went in there with high expectations, people felt that. Once I interviewed Michelle Obama, and she said something like, I think people don't think I exist, meaning that black people like the Obama family, educated, thoughtful, not angry. Remember, they tried to make them angry. And African-Americans realize they have seen folks like that in the community. His very existence challenged people. Remember?
And that makes people angry.
It did.
Because it challenges your preconceived notions.
A congressman yelled, "You lie," mm-hmm. on the floor.
During a State of the Union.
During one of his addresses. This is unheard of.
Right.
The personal insults to the First Family, the racial jokes and memes. And I've seen many of them when I went to, and so these things were out there. And I just think that even sometimes people who supported him, the fact that an African-American was leading this country, it meant somehow the world was changing as they saw it. The country was changing.
So Ron,
and people are uncomfortable with that.
Ron Elving, the president didn't say very much about race until very recently, until the Black Lives Matter movement really happened. And he began to be more open about that and said that one of the people could have been his son. One of the people who had been killed could have been his son. Why does this make people so angry? In what universe did he racially divide the country?
Again, I agree with the others who have said that the division in the country was not invented by Barack Obama, but he fell into the division. He fell into the chasm between the races. The history of the United States is very largely a history of the racial issues that were prompted by the bringing of black slaves from Africa to the United States, starting in the 1600s. And this has been an enormous part of what we have inherited from our ancestors in this country, not just in the South, but all over the country. And this has been something that sometimes we talked about, most of the time we didn't. And when we had to talk about it because of events or because of individuals, Martin Luther King was one of those individuals. There were certainly many, many events long before the 1960s that forced people to talk about race. And it makes people uncomfortable. And beyond that, it makes some people feel threatened and people get angry on both sides. And Barack Obama desperately hoped that his presidency would be part of the healing of that, of closing the chasm, but he brought to the surface many of those feelings that people had thought they could tell themselves they didn't have, and he was not able to overcome that by himself.
And a positive piece of that, though, is we're talking about things like systemic racism, like mass incarceration, like inequality, like segregation of housing and schools.
Will that conversation continue, or is it over now?
I'm not sure it'll continue, and I want to just reiterate Mary's point, and that is, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, Trump's tweet about John Lewis and his district shows an ignorance about the texture of African Americans in this nation. To assume that all African Americans live in a city where you're afraid to get shot, where there's poverty and crime. So I think we have to look at that and say that's still unfortunate. Maybe we've not misunderstood. We've really been ignoring the racism that was there.
Well, let's talk about that, because I don't want to talk about Donald Trump, because that's not what the show is about. I want to talk about President Obama, but is it on his shoulders that he didn't do more? Could he have done more as the first African-American president to elucidate some of these problems and also to inform people about the realities of black life in America?
I would recommend everyone go to the museum on the mall in the Smithsonian.
You can't get in until May.
I know. But that is to say that I always say that you can grow up in the United States of America if you are not a minority, and you can have a successful, educated life and not know anything about the history, the culture, the feelings, the family of people of color.
Because it's not taught in schools and it's not spoken about in society.
It's not required. If you are a person of color, you probably, some of us don't know all of that history. And I certainly learned things when I went to the museum. But you have to know a certain amount to navigate the world. Plus, you have to know everything about the majority culture.
Yeah.
And that is just the way it is.
Okay. Let's hopscotch very quickly through some of the accomplishments that I listed and put them into perspective. The president took a different direction than many people wanted him to take with regard to solving the Great Recession and the financial collapse that he inherited in those first days. It actually began to be worked on by President Bush prior to his arrival in office on January 20th of 2008. But instead of belt tightening and austerity, he spent money. He lent it to failing banks. He propped up the automobile industry, arguably rescued General Motors, and all of the smaller businesses that support General Motors and Chrysler in their efforts. Other people wanted him to shore up those who had faulty mortgages from losing their houses, and he didn't do that. So how will history judge his decision and that course of action?
I think it's always hard to predict what historians will be writing about, and I would take, for example, Harry Truman. He is looked at after his tenure in office, very low approval, kind of not seen as one of the great presidents. Nowadays, I think there's a very different perception of what the Truman administration was like in his presidency. So I'd be careful about trying to figure out what we're going to be looking at in regards to the economics of the country. I think this will be one of the key things that historians will have to grapple with in terms of trying to understand the severity and the different ways that he could have approached it. So many of his political advisors said, stay away from health care, deal with the economy and try and get that taken care of. And I think for a part of the blame, I think that the president would assume is that he felt like he could try and do a lot of things all at the same time.
And can it be said that he did? He did get health care passed, and he did prop up the automobiles and the banks and other businesses.
But he felt like he could do it. Uh-huh. And the core of the presidency is to remember you have to work with the legislative branch. And even with unified party government that he had in the first 2 years, he had to cut a lot of deals that did not go over very well with a lot of people in that time.
Well, and those deals cost John Boehner his position and
cost Nancy Pelosi.
Pelosi. But I think you also add to that list what he did for climate change. And if you look at the Affordable Care Act, as people have said, he was playing long ball. Mm. And I think also we add to that mix not just what he did, but how he approached the office. He came into office and said, I will not use signing statements. He wanted to limit the use of executive orders. And he found that that was one of the only ways that he could get things through and he could make have an impact, even if he knew there were going to be
short-term. Well, isn't that because he could not work with the Congress
sure.
or they would not work with him?
Yeah.
Under his administration, the Dodd-Frank Act passed. Many of the provisions of that are still being worked out. I'm told it's liable to be repealed. But he also created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau as a watchdog for citizens against business. Both the Republicans and Donald Trump have said that they will change all of that. But do the people want the protections that these acts have given them?
Well, they don't want them framed as regulation.
Do they know what these things do? Or do they understand what these things do and why they were maybe considered needed by President Obama?
My short response would be no.
Okay. He inherited this terrible economy. Unemployment in his first year of office was 10%. He leaves with 4.6%. Can that be considered part of his legacy, Ron Elving, or is that simply the business cycle at work?
It's both, but it's surely part of his legacy that he was able to reassure people in the first 6 months of his presidency that we had a credit crunch at that time. We had the entire economy hemorrhaging jobs. We had the markets in free fall. A lot of people lost 40-50% of their 401ks and other savings in the late months of 2008 and the early months of 2009. There was not quite panic abroad in the land. We didn't have very many banks failing, but there was just a whiff of 1931 going on in the United States in 2009, and we forget that because it does seem so much in the rearview mirror and people don't like to remember those kinds of things. So I don't think there's any question but that Barack Obama was able to manage that crisis and restore confidence, something along the lines, I don't want to overdraw the comparison, but something along the lines of what Franklin Roosevelt was able to do when he became president in 1933. But of course, once you get the machinery back up and running, then it's either the success or failure of the machinery from then on. And it has been a success of the private sector, and it has been a success of the auto industry beyond the bailout, and it has been a success of a lot of American institutions. The one thing that did not come along that everyone regrets is wage growth. Wages did not come back until just maybe the last year or so of the Obama presidency. That cost Hillary Clinton dearly.
And the other part of the problem is that also unemployment is down, although the jobs have come back. They're different kinds of jobs in every way. And this was reflected, obviously, in the outcome of the election. There are a lot of very unhappy people out there. Did the president fail to recognize this trend, or is this something that would have happened whether he recognized it or not? Can a president impact that?
Well, you could say that Donald Trump, as you said, won because of this economic insecurity, but so many of these manufacturing jobs are lost not just to overseas but to automation. But people feel insecure if they have to work two and three jobs for the same wages that they had with these strong manufacturing jobs. But that is the nature, too, as I said, of the system, and perhaps no one could do anything to change that.
NBC News has reported that the president oversaw an increase in taxes on the rich to levels not seen since the Reagan administration and redistributing much of that money to lower-income Americans. If that is true, why did those lower-income Americans turn their backs on Democrats in the last election?
Well, probably the people who benefited.
Yeah,
the people who benefited were not necessarily people who had previously had manufacturing jobs. That's a complex. It's a complex algorithm figuring out who benefited from those cuts. But probably most of the people who did benefit from having their taxes actually cut were probably Hillary Clinton voters.
We can't get away from the divisive, the great divide in America that has come from this, at least during this presidency, if not from this presidency. Two listeners have written in. Daniel emails, I think a big part of the division in the United States has to do with the president forcing change via executive orders and with the Supreme Court forcing change, such as same-sex marriage, as opposed to letting Congress come to a consensus on that matter and similar divisive issues as the Constitution and the founders envisioned. Those issues are tough issues that need to be debated over time. Gordon on Twitter says our politics are becoming too divided, not because of the Obama legacy, but because of the way we elect politicians through primaries. We've talked about that many times. So let's go back to Daniel's email. A lot of people complain about activist courts. Isn't that what the founding fathers aren't they operating precisely the way the founding fathers envisioned them to operate?
Well,
they make decisions on laws.
Yeah, and an activist judge is all in the eye of the beholder. If you agree with the judge's ruling, that was a very sound legal principle. If you disagree with it, there goes those wild courts, you know, off again.
The president campaigned on the promise of bringing troops home from Iraq and Afghanistan. He did. He also tried to reprioritize America's interests and determine what was vital to America's interests and pledged not to send troops into harm's way without considering those interests. And yet he has been criticized for weak foreign policy and not getting involved in Syria. Is that criticism fair?
Well, I think when you look at the foreign policy record, we could say Bush, we could put an easy label on it, cowboy diplomacy. It's not easy to put a label on President Obama's foreign policy legacy. And I think people said he was too reticent to do a lot in Syria. But we have to remember taking out Osama bin Laden is another one of the big accomplishments right up there with the Affordable Care Act.
So people were tired of war. They wanted not to be involved.
Sure.
And he chose not. He followed through on that.
That's
now they're criticizing him for what? For not going into Syria?
Well,
for not putting boots on the ground?
What
should he have done?
One of the reasons he won, obviously, was after Bush. People had no taste for this.
Right.
Had no taste for war.
So what should he have done? Is the criticism hollow or is it genuine?
No, I think things like calling ISIS JV and then declaring the red line in Syria, you know, when the president makes a statement, he needs to be willing to back that up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think particularly for the red line issue in Syria, it was seen as if the president is going to stake his credibility and the strength and power of the United States on an issue like genocide, like war crimes in Syria, he better have some kind of plan to back it up. And there was no plan to back that up.
So in 10 or 15 years, Ron Elving, how will we look back and regard his foreign policy?
One of the great what-ifs, of course, is whether or not a commitment in Syria that would have been commensurate to that overheated rhetoric about the red line or a foolish remark such as the comparison to the junior varsity, what if that had led to an actual commitment along the lines of perhaps what we did in Afghanistan or even, God help us, what we did in Iraq. If that had happened, how would we be remembering Barack Obama even at this moment? Let alone 10 or 15 years from now. It would, of course, largely have depended on the fortunes of our arms in Syria. Had we united with, quote, the right people, although those people have never really been identified too well in that country, if we had gotten on the side of the angels, if there is such a side in that conflict, if Assad had been overthrown, if it had not all become part of the Russian orbit, if any of the bad things that seemed quite likely to happen had not happened, and this had turned into something more like the 1991 First Persian Gulf War that seemed to end on pretty good terms for the United States, then perhaps it would have all been a positive. But right now, given the memories we have of the last 10, 12 years, it's extraordinarily difficult to imagine that Syria would not have been another quagmire and utterly destroyed what good feeling there is about Obama's presidency at this stage.
Ron Elving is senior editor correspondent for NPR. Mary C. Curtis with us from Roll Call. Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College. And Michael Bitzer, professor of political science at Catawba College. We're talking about the Obama legacy, how long it will last and what exactly it is. And we will turn our focus to the people who are taking the country back and what that means to the Obama legacy when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar located at Birkdale Village in Lake Norman, offering wines from around the world, live local music, and craft beer on tap. Relax, uncork, unwind. The Corkscrew. Details at thecorkscrew.com. and Dr. John Powderly at Carolina Bio-Oncology Institute in Huntersville, a cancer therapy and research center specializing in immunotherapy clinical trials for metastatic cancer, carolinabiooncology.org. Georgetown University professor and author Michael Eric Dyson makes a fiery challenge to white America: stop ignoring the injustices facing black America. And he will be the guest, along with guest host Jane Clayson, on Point, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. We will continue our conversation about the Obama legacy in just a moment. Stay with us.
We're at the beginning of a new chapter in history.
Donald Trump has said his priority as president is going to be protecting jobs.
What will be President Trump's policy on space exploration?
Well, now let's take a step back and hear about the direction national security might take in the Trump administration.
To understand the people and policies that will shape the country for the next 4 years and beyond, listen every day.
Keep up with your NPR news source, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Obama legacy this morning with Ron Elving, Mary C. Curtis, Susan Roberts, and Michael Bitzer. Part of the unrest on the part of folks who want to take their country back and make America great again stems from the intense amount of social change that has happened in these last 8 years. Obama reversed President Clinton's don't ask, don't tell policy in the military and came reluctantly, some said, to accept same-sex marriage. None of the fallout predicted by naysayers about both of those changes, none of it has occurred. Are either of those things likely to be reversed in the coming years?
I don't see how that can happen, but I think this is one of the tectonic fault lines. Race was one. Social issues was another. Economics was another. I mean, you basically had in one presidency so many different fault lines that were shifting the ground, and people are uncomfortable when that shift occurs and change occurs. And I think that's the backlash that we're seeing.
Well, some people are – when you talk about divisive issues, to some people that's division. Others, it's justice, human rights.
Exactly.
And it's interesting because we talk about partisan divides, red and blue, but – I think within states, I've seen in North Carolina certainly, it's more the cities and urban areas versus the more rural areas.
Right.
Yeah. And that's within one state.
So is he the unhappy recipient of unfortunate serendipity? I mean, just all these things converge, but not because of him, but just happened because whoever was in the office these last 8 years would have faced this. Or is he partly to blame because he did repeal don't ask, don't tell, and he did come to terms with same-sex marriage?
I wouldn't say blame. I would say he was just the embodiment of a new coalition in American society that is very much a change-oriented from what we have seen previously.
Well, I think also, too, if you look at what President Obama could accomplish as a party leader and taking into consideration all the articles about the demise of the Republican Party pre-Trump election. But the Republicans were alive and well at the state level. Under President Obama, the Democrats lost a sizable majority in both the House and the Senate. And that's one of those things in terms of you look at someone and say, well, what kind of party builder? And now that's something that they're looking at Obama and say, where is the Democratic Party?
The
today?
Democratic Party is in disarray. There's no question, particularly at the national level. And I think it stems from the local level. I've said for a long time that in North Carolina, the Democratic Party sometimes looks hapless. But then nationally, they sometimes look hapless in the face of right-wing media and Rush Limbaugh and people like that. But could it be said, Ron, that his legislative accomplishments in the first 2 years when he had this Democratic Congress at his heels were actually galvanized Republicans to the success that they've experienced to date?
I don't think there's any question. I think when you look at the Democrats with almost 60% of the seats in the House in 2009 and briefly 60 votes in the Senate, didn't last very long, not even a whole Congress. But the thought of one party having 60 votes, that was a holy grail neither party really expected to be able to get to. So in that moment, it was possible for much to be accomplished in a short period of time. And knowing that it was only going to be a closing window, The Democrats tried to do a lot in that short period of time. That galvanized their opposition, along with a lot of other factors that we've already discussed, and we didn't even mention the term Tea Party, but that was one way to describe the big pushback that came almost immediately in the spring of 2009. So when you consider all of that, there's an argument to be made for going for what you can get, establishing a new direction for the country, and then accepting the fact that every time you take a couple of steps forward in our history, you're going to take at least one step back.
Given that he has, it seems that he's accomplished a lot, even though a lot of people may not like it when his name is attached to something, they like the essence of it. Even the president has said that he's done a better job of telling his story on the campaign trail than he did while he was in office. Why wasn't he able to? He was able to communicate this whole idea of hope and change, which caused him to be swept into office, but not tell the story of what he was accomplishing while in office, effectively.
Well, that's kind of a contradiction, because he is rightly praised for his eloquence, but even he has said that he hasn't communicated it as well.
But why?
And it hasn't trickled down. Well, it's interesting, because Obama, the person, people are really drawn to, but somehow when he isn't on the ballot in those midterm elections, the coalition that elected him.
Yeah, but there were many times when he didn't seem to be fighting back. I mean, he would put forth these ideas. He would get them through the Congress, or he would get them through because of an executive order. They would help people. People would like what they experienced because of it, but they didn't like his name attached to it because that was a bad thing. Why wasn't he able to break through and say, "Hey, I've done this, and here's how it works, and you're benefiting from it, and you say you like it"? Why didn't he stick up for himself?
Well, in the beginning, I believe that he felt that there would be more cooperation. It took him a while to realize that he was going to have to be a little bit more strong in his...
Well, you know that the tweeter-in-chief is going to do that.
You mean the tweeter and the birther-in-chief.
Well, but he's going to do that. And do you think that will be a positive thing? I mean, because he'll speak directly to people. He will go around the media. He will go around other Republicans. He will go right to you.
He's a showman. A businessman. Yeah. And he's an entertainer. We like that. He's been very... we, meaning Americans, have seemed to... the thing of it is, though, is when the policies start to be implemented, and if people do get hurt, if their health care is taken away, and if the mines don't reopen and he can't keep those promises, will people call him to account?
President Obama has been saying recently that we are the change we were looking for 8 years ago. But is that what people thought they were getting when they voted for him in 2008, that they would have to work for change, or did they think he was going to do it all for them?
Well, I think when you talked about what happened in the midterms, many of the people that brought him to office did not vote. There wasn't a healthy turnout of African Americans. There wasn't a healthy turnout of young voters. And I think when President Obama, as opposed to the tweeter-in-chief, he was a reflector and not a reactor. And I think for me, that sums up a lot. And he used the bully pulpit in a way that was, as you said earlier, no drama Obama. And now we have total drama.
And this election was also about change. People want change. And I'm curious, Ron Elving, do you think Donald Trump is going to be better equipped to bring about that change because he'll be working with a Republican Congress? Of course, we had a Democratic president who worked with a Democratic Congress for a while. Will he be more successful at this?
Well, he should be able to count on his Republican majorities lasting longer. Just because of the way that the districts are drawn around the country, the Republicans are pretty safe in control of the House, at least until 2020, maybe 2022. And so he can count on having a Republican House, and that's just a huge advantage for a Republican president. As far as the Senate, the way that the seats are up in 2018, the Democrats are going to have to defend something like 2/3 or more of all the seats that are even going to be on the ballot. And many of those seats they're defending are in states that voted for Donald Trump. So all indications would be that Donald Trump should have 4 years at least of a Republican Congress to work with. That's a huge boon if Barack Obama could have had that in his first term, if he could have had it beyond his first term. I suspect this entire conversation would be quite different.
Mary.
And there is a danger that Republicans could overreach. That is the problem. You saw when they first got in where they tried to change the ethics rules late at night, and there was pushback. And so that is always a danger when you have that power. Sometimes you get a little too heady, and then you get the pushback.
A Pew Research Center survey reports that 45% of Americans think President Obama will be remembered as an outstanding or above average president, the highest average for an outgoing president since Ronald Reagan. He has high popularity ratings as well. 58% say they approve of his performance. 64% say they have a favorable impression of him personally. Given those extraordinarily high ratings for an 8-year president, how do you explain that his successor is not Hillary Clinton and that he wasn't able to elevate her to that position by using his own popularity, and that, in fact, his successor will be his polar opposite?
Two factors I would point to. The first and probably the most important is that going into the election, 2/3 of Americans said the country was on the wrong track.
But they like him, so why would they say that? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Exactly. And part of it is also that you have to dive deeper into that and explain why the people feel the country is on the wrong track. And I think a lot of it is based on partisanship. Republicans did not like and do not like President Obama, and Democrats do not like Republicans because they don't like President Obama. So I think that component is there. It's also one of the fundamentals in political science that getting a third term is very hard for the same
party. Well, he said if he had run, he would have won a third term. If it was legally allowed, he could have won. Do you think that's true?
Well, I gave up predicting when I thought Donald Trump was out after he insulted John McCain. But I want to just reiterate what Michael has said. And you quoted the Pew Research Center. They said, and I don't know exactly the numbers, but among strong partisans, 20-30% see the policies of the other party as being, and these are their words, quote, as a threat to the nation. Not just they don't like that. They also ask questions about, would you be upset if your son or daughter married someone of a different party? And there was a healthy percent of people that said, yes, we would be upset.
The divide between Democrats and Republicans is wider than ever. But, Ron, has it ever been said before recent history that the policies of the opposition party are dangerous to the country?
I don't think we should take too much credit or too much drama to the divisions of our time. I do believe the divisions of the 1930s, which are largely forgotten in our general memory of that time, were quite deep and quite virulent. And we have certainly had other divisions over issues in the past. When people say since the Civil War, people forget just how long the Civil War went on, if you know my
meaning. It's still going on, I think.
Yeah, and that's
certainly what William Faulkner said.
And the thing is, too, we talk about division, but think about the times when President Barack Obama brought the country together, when he was the consoler-in-chief in Tucson after Gabby Giffords, in Charleston after Sandy Hook.
But has that made a difference because he was not able to budge the needle on gun control or even reasonable gun control?
Well, and I think there was an article or a video about every time he came on and had to address the nation after every event of gun violence. And it showed, I think he said at one time, this is the 12th or the 13th time that I have done this. And you could see the wear on his face and his frustration and his sadness.
Yes. It didn't seem to have an impact.
You know, we have...
Go ahead, Ron.
We've asked Barack Obama to change a lot of things here in the last hour and in the last 8 years. And among other things, we have asked him in the last 8 years to change the fundamental way Americans relate to guns. And while sometimes the polls tell us that more and more and more people favor reasonable gun control, when it gets down to the actual political process, the power of the people who want to defend the Second Amendment is far greater than anyone ever imagined, and they always prevail.
In presidential farewell addresses, presidents sometimes warn us of things that they see on the horizon. George Washington warned us about involvement in European affairs. Eisenhower, of course, warned us about the military-industrial complex, which, my God, is absolutely true. President Obama used his to warn us of threats to our democracy. democracy and our national unity that seem a pretty clear on the surface that we are not unified. So do these words take on a stronger meaning because they come from the same man who 12 years ago made a name for himself by refusing to see a nation divided?
Well, I think he also said, I mean, you could take some of those words that he wanted us to have to look at democracy, little d, the Constitution, faith in the documents of our founding, because he sees those as being threatened with this new administration. And I think that's what Obama would like to leave, as he called it in his farewell address, this bold experiment. And I think we can't, you know, audacity and hope, we can't underestimate how bold this experiment was. And I think Ron is absolutely right. We ask him to do so much.
For President-elect Trump to be successful, does he have to dismantle a lot of what Barack Obama did? And if he does that, what becomes of whatever Obama legacy there may be?
I think that's the great unknown right now. I think from a from Republicans' point of view, they want things dismantled. I think from Democrats, they will want things kept in place. I think for the great middle, it could go either way in terms of how things are framed. And I think, you know, this is the division that we have. It's not going to get solved. It's not going to be repaired. The breach is too deep, I think.
Mary.
Yeah, and I think that President Barack Obama is banking on the fact that Americans are still aspirational, that they want to be better and they want to do better. We will see what happens.
Do you think that's true?
Well, he said we all have to start with the premise that each of our fellow citizens loves this country just as much as we do. So it's a challenge. And as Michael said, we will see.
So we have a minute left. What's the bottom line here? Will President Obama eventually be viewed as a president of consequence or an inconsequential one? And will that be determined by whether or not Republicans take his policies down in the next 4 years? Ron Elving.
I think he'll be remembered as highly consequential, even if the Republicans try to dismantle and succeed in dismantling much of what he did. I think that much of it will survive in spirit, and much of it will be reparable or restorable at some future point.
Ron Elving from NPR. I have 30 seconds left. Michael.
I agree with everything that Ron said.
Michael Bitzer, Catawba College. Susan.
Consequential, not maybe as much transformative.
Susan Roberts from Davidson College. Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call.
Definitely historical.
Absolutely, unequivocally historical. You are correct. Thank you all for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Thank you.